In today's episode of the Nerd by Word, we are going to return back to 2006's Superman Returns, see how it held up, and if it didn't, we're going to fix it. Stick around. Welcome into episode 188 of the Nerd by Word. We are so thankful that you're on this journey with us. We are taking a look at 2006's Superman Returns and applying our fixes to the film to try and see if we can't make a better product at the end of this episode. But first, in the spirit of Superman and Clark Kent and journalism and all those endeavors, we're going to keep it flowing with... And just like the consistency of Clark Kent, Dave, you are beating the drum for physical media once more.
Yeah, just, you know, kind of checking in with where things are standing when it comes to physical media. As we have already previously talked about on this pod, physical media is very much slowly fading away. It's on the way out in favor of stuff like streaming, with several stores sort of starting to back off. Best Buy, late last year, I think, announced that they're going to stop selling movies in store, and I don't think there's any listings even on their website now anymore. There's been some talk about Walmart reducing floor space when it comes to DVDs, Blu-rays, and as well as physical video games. And now Target is officially joining that list. Turns out that Target is backing off of physical media as well. So it's interesting. A Target spokesperson told IGN that the retailer is transitioning to a limited assortment of DVDs. And so the plan is apparently that physical movies and TV shows will return to stores during the holidays when Target suggests people are more likely to buy a DVD. Here is the quote from the spokesperson as given to IGN. Based on our guests' shopping patterns and broader industry trends, we're transitioning the limited assortment of DVDs we carry in our stores to Target.com, where guests will continue to find thousands of titles. Moving forward, we'll offer select DVDs in stores when they are newly released or during key times throughout the year when they are more popular, like for gift giving during the holidays. So this apparently will not affect video games in Target for the time being. They continue to plan to dedicate shelf space to video games. Now, obviously, things have been tremendously changing in this regard, both with DVDs and Blu-rays, but also with video games. Alan Wake 2, for example, was the first AAA video game that skipped a physical release entirely and can only be bought digitally. That was in 2023. In 2024, Microsoft also confirmed that Senua Saga Hellblade 2 was also going to skip a physical release. Obviously, Best Buy and Walmart are starting to back off of some physical media. Really notable, and I have a story here that I think is going to be near and dear to your heart, Chris. Notably, Disney actually shut down its long-running DVD Blu-ray movie club. So I want to actually talk about the Disney Movie Club for a second, because I was, for a short time, a member of this club, very specifically for something that you might appreciate. In the 1990s, Disney released a remake of The Three Musketeers, starring, among many people, Chris O'Donnell and Kiefer Sutherland, and Charlie Sheen as well. And I have a very soft spot for this movie, even though it's not the most accurate depiction of The Three Musketeers. Turns out, dude, Tim Curry...
Understatement of the century.
Tim Curry... As a villain is always going to be watchable to me, okay? No matter how much they butcher the actual book. So I had a big soft spot for this movie, and you could, in fact, not find it anywhere. it just was not findable. This was before the launch of Disney Plus. And so the only way that you could purchase this movie was
they
exclusively...
They were trying to spare you.
Exclusively... hilarious. Exclusively through the Disney Movie Club. So I specifically joined the Disney Movie Club just to get my grubby little hands on this movie, which I had not seen since I was a kid, and really, really wanted to see again. And again, in accuracy be darned, there are some interesting performances in there. I think Oliver Platt is in there, and he's a lot of fun. Tim Curry as a villain is always a win, if you ask me. And so I wanted to watch this movie again, which was a big part of my childhood, and was actually the movie that inspired me to read the original Three Musketeers book. So it was a gateway for me in some ways. When I'm looking at just the breadth of this, I'll say what I always say at this point, which is I have inherently no problem with the transition away from physical media, if that's the way of the world, although there are things about it I'm going to miss. What I am concerned with is the kind of stuff like what Max has been doing with its wholesale removal of stuff from its streaming services, which kind of, to me at least, signals that we could very well end up in a world soon where you will simply not be able to watch certain movies or television series at all anymore. You know, like things are just going to start vanishing from these streaming services because they're taking up server space and, they want to save money on server space. And so these things are going to vanish. And since there's going to be less and less options of actually purchasing media, I'm concerned for film preservation a little bit. That's sort of my real concern here is just long-term preservation. I would be very troubled if there are certain things that I would never be able to watch again, or as my son gets older, I will not be able to introduce him to, because there is no physical media to buy it on, and nobody wants to stream it, you know? So I have concerns about this move. Ultimately, it is the way of the world. It's the march of progress and technology. But I really strongly hope that there is a way to continue preserving media, even if it's not your favorite media, Chris.
That's a tough sell. That's a tough sell. Number one, that movie is an abomination. Horrendous. Bad. As in many of his appearances, Oliver Platt remains a bright spot in a forgettable film or project. I always go up for Oliver Platt. I loved him as Paul Bunyan in Tall Tale. Now, there's a 90s Disney throwback for you. Tall Tale. I used to love the crap out of that movie. But yeah, as far as that goes, it's funny. Part of me is starting to think that this is going to be one of those cyclical things, at least to a certain extent. I mean, we're living in an age right now where vinyls are making a comeback, in for no other reason than for like a vintage kind of escapism / hipstery kind of vibes. And so I don't know, maybe that if it were me, as someone who worked in retail and Walmart specifically, always tried to push products, it kind of escapes me why they wouldn't make a DVD player or something like super cheap and then have like some kind of incentive to buy up a bunch of this inventory. So I don't know, I think it's kind of cyclical. Maybe physical media, DVDs and Blu-rays will make a comeback in a couple of years. But maybe I'm just spouting here.
Well, look, and I think there are ways that, you know, this kind of physical media can be at least somewhat preserved, right? I think, for example, there are some movies that, like, are basically print on demand at this point because I guess demand is not very high. So they're like things that you can buy, for example, on Amazon that they literally like burn for you right then and there and send to you. I think that kind of model may be something in the future. And yeah, I think that we're eventually going to see a resurgence of appreciation for physical media, especially if these streaming services start, you know, removing stuff. I liken it to maybe like the comeback of vinyl a little bit. Vinyl is, you know, like really big again here the last few years. And I've certainly always appreciated vinyl as a format and have a pretty big collection of vinyl records myself. So I can see a resurgence in this. At the very least, there might be some kind of nostalgia that jump starts it again. But like I said, my overall concern is just preservation long term, you know. That I think is sort of my number one concern in all of this. Alrighty, Chris, so that brings us to one of the most maligned moments in comic books of the last few months. Let's go ahead and talk about it.
Well, we got a potentially messy situation here. In an interview with Amazing Spider Talk, Cody Ziegler, who is currently writing Spider-Man Miles Morales, said of the very maligned, as you said, killing off and then immediate resurrection of Kamala Khan to make her a mutant, said, quote, "It was funny watching when the whole Kamala stuff was going down. He, referencing Zeb Wells, had told me months before the plan. Feige was like, hey, I don't do this very often, but can you please do this to make things in line with Marvel because we have some stuff we want to do with Kamala," end quote. And so it seems that Kevin Feige is stepping in and having direct control of what happens in the comics. This is something that has been a complaint of comic readers for quite some time, is the MCUification of Marvel Comics. But now we have it straight from one of the creators themselves saying it. There's a lot of different ways that we could steer this discussion. First and foremost, Marvel immediately said that that was not accurate. And so, first and foremost, I hope as a Cody Ziegler fan, this doesn't impact his work with the company or writing comics. If he is forced to go to another publisher, I will follow him. He's one of those few people that, like, I'll read whatever he's writing. And so I hope that they don't punish him for this. It's not surprising, secondarily, as someone who's defended Zeb Wells for a lot of reasons and a lot of things that he's done over the past few years. It's pretty crappy that he was the one taking the brunt of this. He was the one receiving death threats when it wasn't even his decision. It was something he was forced to do. At the end of the day, though, like, it's kind of weird the trajectory of this character, because beloved character, great Disney Plus series, in my opinion. They make her a mutant. Like, we all saw the writing on the wall when this happened. I think the optics of it, admittedly, were awful. I think the overreaction was real, because it's comic books, but at the same time, you cannot dismiss the optics of how bad it looks. During AAPI month is when this happened, when it was released. But we do all that. We go through all this hullabaloo for her to become a mutant, become a member of the X-Men, and then summarily we have the latest Hellfire Gala and mutants are completely reset and we're like, what? For what? And now she's got a second solo mini series, and it's so weird that, like, they've gone through all these hoops, taken all of this PR nightmare damage, and what's the end result? I'm just completely at a loss in regards to all of this.
Well, from the comic book perspective, she was able to maintain more of the comic book presence, it feels like, before she became a mutant, right? Like, she's not had an ongoing in a while. She's had a couple of minis since that happened, and that's about it. So it definitely was not for the benefit of the comic book version, right? It was all for corporate synergy, even if it doesn't necessarily work in the context of the comic books, I think. And you're right, there's big upheaval in the X office right now. They're redoing all this stuff and moving out of the Krakoa era. And so where does that leave, you know, Kamala? She cannot really return to a solo series devoid of references to the X-Men world now anymore. She's intrinsically linked. And so just having, you know, a straight-up solo book without constant, you know, a connection to the X world seems to be incredibly unlikely at this point. I was not a big fan of this decision, obviously, and I spoke about that at length. I think really that if you're going to do it, there were probably better ways to do it, right? It was very sloppy and haphazardly done. And ultimately, I don't think it's really benefited the character in any way, shape, or form. It's also probably fair to say that although the character of Kamala Khan in the MCU has been well received, the Marvels obviously was not, even though I kind of like that movie.
That's for the wrong reason. I don't want to include that in this equation, because that's not a fair assumption, though.
It's for the wrong reasons, right? That movie was disliked. But I think ultimately what we end up doing is, I think they wanted to make this choice in the lead up to the Marvel, specifically because they said this is going to be massive, this is going to be huge, and then people are going to want more of the character, and then they're going to wonder why she's not a mutant in the comics, so we're going to have the synergy. And I don't think that particular prediction really came to pass. And now she's in this really weird place where they made major changes to the character that have not really been of benefit to the character so far on the comic book side of things. And it looks at, on the movie side of things, like it's going to be a significant time before we see the character again. The last rumor floating around is that she was going to be integral in starting sort of a Young Avengers kind of team, but there's not been an official announcement of a movie like that. Nothing, right? So the next appearance of the MCU version of Kamala Khan is very much up in the air, which means the comic book version has to carry the torch again for I don't know how many years. And again, it's not really benefited the character, I think, significantly, because she's not even getting an ongoing out of all of this. She's just gotten a couple of miniseries. So, I understand the decision to a certain extent, but I don't appreciate the execution. And as far as Wells is concerned, I feel bad for Wells in a number of ways. And not just about this situation. I get the feeling in reading a lot of Amazing Spider-Man that there is a lot of stuff coming from on high and a lot of editorial mm-hmm. interference in that book. It constantly seems to be shifting. There's very much the goalpost keeps moving. There's mm-hmm. a lot of lack of internal consistency in his run. And I know from reading Wells' other work that Wells is a very consistent writer. Wells can tell a story, right? So these inconsistencies are, well, inconsistent with Wells' previous work. So my only assumption can be is that there's significant editorial interference.
What's the common denominator? Yeah.
Yes, and that is really taking a giant dump on you know his run on this character, and I find that incredibly troubling and sad. And you know, there have been moments in Wells' run of Spider-Man that hint at a much better run on the character, but the problem.
Can you imagine what this run would be? And I will always go up for this run. I enjoy nearly every issue. I walk away happy on this run. But can you imagine the unchecked ability to just write what Spider-Man story you want to write that Jonathan Hickman is afforded with Ultimate? Can you imagine how great that run would be?
I think it would be significantly better at the very least than what we're getting right now, right? Like the Tombstone stuff early on in the run, I thought was really, really strong and really, you know, brought a character back into the forefront that had been, you know, sort of pushed aside, you know, and I really always liked the Tombstone character. So
once we get away from the, oh no, Peter MJ, no kissy kissy stuff, and the whole Paul and all of that, we go right back to the Tombstone stuff, and it's been perfectly fine since.
Well, perfectly fine. I have, you know, one of these days, man, I don't think the run is going to last much longer, and we can do a dissection of the entire run, kind of like we did with the previous one, the Spencer run. But I'm going to tell you, man, I have significant problems in places of this run, but I have issues putting that at Wells' feet. And I'm not talking necessarily about the MJ Peter thing. My preference, I think, I've made clear many a times. But that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy stories that don't include, you know, a relationship between the two or marriage. It's very much the same with Superman. I really enjoy what has happened since the 90s, since Lois and Clark have gotten married. I think that dynamic works incredibly well in the comic. But I still frequently read comic books like Superman 78, for example, and the like, where there is no marriage between the two or no relationship between the two, and I can enjoy those stories just fine. I do think this run has significant issues. I think the problem is that a lot of fans, A, are taking this way too seriously. Anything that involves death threats towards a creator is ridiculous, okay? If you don't like the story, that's fine. Then don't like the story. But death threats are redonkulous at this point. But I think that a lot of this is not really Wells' fault. I think a lot of the things that people dislike are ultimately editorial mandates. And I think that editorial interference... There's a great series of articles about the Clone Saga and the whole behind-the-scenes decision-making and who was involved and who came up with what. It's called The Life of Riley. If you've never read that and you're a Spider-Man fan, I highly recommend it. It's posted online, free, just, you know, it's a lengthy read. I think it's like 35 parts or something. But the behind-the-scenes machinations and why certain things happened the way they did is fascinating. And I feel, if you give this 20 years, eventually we're going to get something like that for this run. I think there is something going on behind the scenes because it's just way too inconsistent. There's way too much stuff that's all over the place. And there are way too many brilliant moments in this juxtaposed with really, really... god-awful moments, like, for example, this Kamala Khan situation, that just screams editorial interference. It really does.
Well, and I'm this is partly on me, but I'm not crazy about the fact that this Kamala discussion has derailed into a Peter Parker discussion. But to kind of steer it back, it's the whole MCUification, all of this, it's kind of weird how they kind of pick and choose which characters they choose to do this with. Because at the same time, same film, you have Monica Rambeau, who for all intents and purposes should be in the spotlight. And she had a great, great miniseries. I believe I nerd commended it by Eve Ewing. And where did, what have we done? What have we done since?
Nothing, man, nothing. You know, it's a fascinating character, and I really, really found her incredibly likable in the Marvels as well, and I would like to see more, but the comic books are not carrying the torch there, so...
This is a character in the 80s who led the Avengers, and we can't put her in a book. Come on.
Marvel's got problems. Yeah.
Well, that wraps up our rantings and ravings and nerd news. We still have a Byword Big Talk to get to, so stick around. Welcome back to this week's main segment. We call this our Byword. Big Talk! And we are transitioning from one sore subject to the next, from our dissatisfaction with certain aspects of comics to the poor cinematic representation of Superman. We're looking at 2006's Superman Returns, and we are trying to fix this sucker because I think Dave, this was the first Superman movie I ever saw, and no wonder I was buying into the tropes of that were lobbed against this character. But so we if you haven't listened to one of our fixing episodes in a while, we each have three big fixes, and then for the ones that need a little extra TLC, then we have a lightning round of fixes. And let me tell you, spoiler alert, this one we needed the lightning round for. So, Dave, this episode, last episode was at my request. This episode was at your request. This is very near and dear to your heart. This is something that's very, very important to you. Give us your first fix of Superman Returns.
So before I jump into my first fix, I just want to go ahead and clarify my perspective on this movie. I was neck deep in the lead up to this movie. Active online, perusing forums, reading rumors, checking every bit of casting news. I was always a huge Superman fan, and one of the essential introductions for me to the character was, you know, the Richard Donner version of Superman, you know, as portrayed by Chris Reeve. And so when this movie was announced, after constant start and stop in trying to get some kind of Superman movie off the ground, I was here for it, man. I was so excited to have Superman back on the big screen. You got to remember the last Superman movie on the big screen at this point had been Superman IV: The Quest for Peace in 1987, a decidedly low-budget affair that was extremely maligned by well, everybody in the general public and in the fandom. So by the time this movie actually was released, it had been almost 20 years since you know, there had been a Superman movie on the big screen. And in addition to that, 1987 was not exactly a time that I would have been able to go to the movies to watch Superman, because I was like 3 or 4 at the time that movie came out. So
I was negative one.
Yeah, so this was my chance to see Superman on the big screen, and I pored over every bit of trailer footage. I downloaded trailers and like freeze frame to try to catch stuff going on in the background. I'm neck deep in this movie. And so as we discuss different things about it, I will probably be able to add context to a lot of stuff that was going on at the time, speculation, stuff that had been talked about, interviews. I remember a lot of the lead up to this movie. But most importantly, I remember my massive disappointment. So my first fix for the 2006 Superman Returns is simply to ditch the nostalgia. And I have to laugh because I actually put a quote in our Google Doc from a Patrick Stump song. I wrote in here, "Oh, nostalgia, I don't need you anymore." So at the time, the announcement that came along with the naming of Bryan Singer as the director of this movie was that it was going to be in continuity with the Donnerverse, with the you know, Richard Donner Superman movies, which is a misnomer in some ways, and there's a lot of lack of clarity about continuity, right? So just to recap that briefly, Richard Donner, of course, famously directed Superman the movie, the first one in 1978 with Chris Reeve. But what a lot of people don't know is that he actually was hired to film two movies simultaneously, both Superman the movie and Superman 2. And at the time that he was about 80% done with Superman 2, they ran out of money. And so the decision was made to release Superman 1 first, and if it is successful, use profits from that to finance the completion of Superman 2. And that was, you know, pretty smart thing, I guess, overall, because they really needed the funds. So what Donner did in order to get Superman 1 out of the door is he took the ending of Superman 2, which is that whole, like, Superman flies around the Earth and reverses, you know, time, and he tacked it onto Superman 1 as the finale, and basically saying, I'm going to figure out the ending for Superman 2 later. The problem was that Donner then and the Salkins, the producers on the Superman movies, had a falling out. Donner was removed from Superman 2, and a different director, Richard Lester, which, if I remember correctly, you should have a familiarity with, Chris, because those Richard Chamberlain Three Musketeers movies that were decidedly more comedic in tone were directed by Richard Lester. So Lester was brought in to finish Superman 2, but rather than just finishing Superman 2 and trying to figure out the ending, he went through a lengthy series of reshoots to put his own spin on the movie. And of course, the ending that he came up with, to sort of rewind time and undo things, was a magic kiss that Superman placed on Lois to wipe her memory. And I think this is going to be something we're going to have to talk later about, because I think it speaks to the continuity problems with this movie. The sense at the time when the movie came out is that it was going to basically jump off the continuity of Superman 1 and Superman 2 and ignoring 3 and 4. But there was also a lot of rumbling at the time that the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2 was going to come, which eventually did come out, and I think is the superior movie. And so it was very unclear if this was supposed to be in continuity of Superman 2, the theatrical cut, or Superman 2, the Donner cut, which is a long way to say that there was a lot of confusion about continuity just from the announcement that this was going to be in continuity with the Chris Reeves, Richard Donner Superman movies. And I think many of the problems of this movie land squarely at the feet of the fact that this is supposed to be a continuation, a 20-year too late sequel to a franchise that had been dormant for 20 years, right? And so who is this for? You know, is this for a whole bunch of, you know, elderly that that remember the original series? What was the expectation that everybody that comes to the movie is intimately familiar with the Donner movies? And more importantly, this movie is in many ways a remix of Superman the movie. That's what this is. It's kind of reminiscent of how The Force Awakens is basically a remix of the original Star Wars. You know, desert planet, a person on the desert planet gets on a ship and escapes, gets thrown into adventure. Like the rhythm of the movie is very similar. You know, Superman crash lands in different context, of course. Superman ends up in Metropolis. Superman has to, you know, prevent natural disasters. Superman goes on a night flight with Lois. Like, all the beats of Superman the movie are here as a remix. And so instead of telling a original story, a new story, even if it were in continuity with the Donner movies, is not what happens here. Instead, it is basically... it's basically a remix. And I think that is 90% of the failure of this movie. The plot of the villain is a remix of the evil scheme from Superman 1. It's that is the overall problem. It's very, very familiar ground. And those beats don't necessarily work in the context of this story and this movie. And so my first fix is very simple. Reject the nostalgia and tell your own story. And I think that would have fixed a huge chunk of problems that this movie has.
You want to know something that's hilarious? I had this as one of my fixes, or maybe even a lightning round, but then I saw your first fix and I was like, oh, we'll just talk about it then. Because this film is essentially The Force Awakens.
It is.
It is. It's a karaoke version of the first film. Now, admittedly, The Force Awakens does a much better job, in my opinion, of singing the karaoke. And still, like, even if it is a remix, as you say, or replaying the old hits, Force Awakens is far superior in that regard. Agreed. And as you said, it just doesn't land here. So yeah, I had the exact same, note, and I'm just blending it in here, is like, this is The Force Awakens for Superman. Even there are elements of it where I texted you, I said, this is how Superman got his groove back, except he didn't. So like, it's just, yeah, so I'm right there with you. Like, it all the potential is there. Like, there are elements, and I'll get into this with one of my fixes, there are elements that work of this film, but like, it's just like so much wasted potential, I feel, and that's maybe its greatest sin.
And I will just say this as sort of a final word on this nostalgia issue for now. I think that trying to duplicate a previous generation's version of Superman with new actors also means that all of the actors, particularly Brandon Routh, are incredibly restrained by the previous depiction. They're not able to forge their own ground with these characters, and that leads to a whole bunch of problems in the portrayal of Superman, in the portrayal of Clark Kent, in the portrayal of Lois Lane, in the portrayal of Lex Luthor. There is a restraint on every performance as they're trying to not move too far away from what came before, and they come across as
wooden and hollow as a result.
Exactly. That is exactly right. All right, Chris, now that I've rambled for half an hour, how about you go ahead and you hit me with your first fix here?
So the first note that I have is that there are absolutely essential recasts that have to take place. Much has been said about Brandon Routh being a perfect casting for Superman, but just horrendously underutilized. To what we saw with the Kingdom Come situation in the Arrowverse, coming back to great fanfare.
How sad is it, Chris, that we have to point to the Arrowverse as the superior acted and written version of this Superman?
Okay, but, which, all due respect, I'm not going back to the Arrowverse. So, thoughts and prayers. I'm glad that y'all enjoyed it. I'm not watching that again. is where we get... you know, similar situation with Andrew Garfield. Now, I don't feel like the... Maybe the second one, because I haven't watched the second one in a while, but I don't feel like the Amazing Spider-Man film, the first one at least, is as unfortunate as this one. I'll say unfortunate. But we got his kind of redemption, if you will, with No Way Home. If you ask me, I think he's the star of that film.
Oh, agreed.
But I'm biased. I've always ridden for Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man, but that's neither here nor there. And so I've rambled a lot, but I say all that to say this. I think there are two. So Ralph is beloved, universally beloved, largely. But I think that there are two recasts that just have to happen. And this is no disrespect to Kate Bosworth. This is a very 2006 casting. This is very Blue Crush coming off of that. She's hot and she's a surfer girl and people like her. And so this just feels like a stunt casting. And I'm sure she's a wonderful person. I don't know a lot of her work like that. I think I took a date to Blue Crush and that's about as much as I remember of Kate Bosworth. She does not give me Lois Lane at all. Like, at all. Even in my limited knowledge of Lois Lane at the time, which was incredibly remedial. It's much more informed now, and I even feel even stronger about it. So I was looking at actresses in 2006 that were kind of in their power that could do this. Give me Rachel McAdams as Lois Lane. Give me Rachel McAdams coming off of Mean Girls, coming off of The Notebook. You already have great chemistry with her and James Marsden. Sorry to that relationship, how it turned out in The Notebook, but I think she'd be perfect in this role. So again, no disrespect to Kate Bosworth. And then the other recasting that has to happen, simply because we want our on-screen villains to be fictional, not real-life villains. So we need to recast Lex Luthor. Kevin Spacey, this is a really difficult movie to revisit. Every scene that he's in makes me uncomfortable because he's a real-life villain. And so I did a little bit more research and, like, who could have really kind of portrayed Lex Luthor at this time, 2006? And it's funny because at the same time I was looking for a news story this morning, I saw our favorite director, Zack Snyder, was talking about how Leonardo DiCaprio had lots of thoughts on Lex Luthor for Batman versus Superman. And that's exactly who I had cast already in this recasting. So I think Leo would be great as Lex Luthor. If you wanted to go a little bit older, I kind of like the idea of Lex Luthor and Superman Clark being relatively close in age. So I kind of like the idea of Leo being Lex Luthor. I like the idea of what they're going with Corin Sweat and Nicholas Holt being similar in age. But if you did want to keep that older, I go with Bryan Cranston. I know that this is before Breaking Bad took off, but so if you want an older Lex, go with Bryan Cranston. I know that's a popular fan cast, but I think those are the two things that just have to happen to make this film just ultimately more enjoyable and watchable, if nothing else.
You know, I'm a great armchair casting agent. This is not a joke. A lot of people who
end up... I'm not, and I'm pretty proud. I'm not, usually, because I don't watch enough media to be in the know, so I'm pretty proud of this one, though.
So you need to understand something about this era in my life, I think, and that is that during this time period, I was in college, and one of the many jobs that I worked to pay for my way through school was that I was actually a video store clerk. for 4 years, I worked as a video store clerk. So I consumed a ton
RIP, of media. RIP to that industry as a whole.
Yeah. It was a good time in my life, let's put it that way. And I have several comments I can add here. Like, for example, I can tell you that I did a lot of casting during this time. I would, for example, see Christian Bale in a little-known science fiction movie called Equilibrium. And I said, holy crap, he would make a great Batman. And then he got cast as Batman. Like, that's literally how like half of my media time worked. Is I would just like pick out an actor in a little known movie and be like, they would be great in this superhero movie. And then sure enough, boom, that's where they would end up. But the great missed opportunity and one of my all-time favorite fan casts that I had at the time was Rachel McAdams as Lois Lane. I think that is one of the great missed opportunities in superhero media. She just screams Lois Lane, the spunk, the twinkle in her eye. I think she would have put in one of the greatest Lois Lane performances of all time. A note on Bosworth. I think this might be something that elucidates the issue here. I think part of the reason we have Bosworth in this movie is actually Kevin Spacey. If I remember my history correctly from this time period, in 2004, so 2 years before Superman Returns came out, Kevin Spacey had sort of a, let's call it a pet project. He was a big fan of the singer Bobby Darin and produced a bioflick with himself as Bobby Darin called Beyond the Sea. And he cast Kate Bosworth opposite himself in that movie. And if I remember things correctly from this time period, Spacey was an actual early casting for this movie as Lex Luthor, and it may have been him who actually suggested Bosworth as Lois Lane during this time period. I agree that Bosworth is very, very badly miscast in the role of Lois Lane. Part of that, I think, is the writing. I don't think the writing is very good for Lois in this movie.
I can talk more about that
a little later. But I think one of the things that would have worked better for this movie, not perfect, because I think perfect would have been Rachel McAdams, I 100% agree with you, but one of the things that I think would have at least helped is if they would have swapped Parker Posey and Kate Bosworth's roles in this movie.
Who I thought was Elizabeth Banks for the first half of the film.
Yeah, Parker Posey, I think, would have made a better Lois Lane, and it would have actually recalled a little bit the fact that there was an age difference between Chris Reeve and Margot Kidder in the Superman movies as well. So Parker Posey would have been a slightly older Lois. I think that would have probably worked better in the long run for this movie. Because, yeah, I totally agree. And yes, the Luther thing is weird in this movie anyways, not just because of the spacey of it all, but also, but also because the writing is trying to walk this tightrope between the goofier Gene Hackman version and something that's a little bit more threatening. And it never quite strikes that balance properly.
It never
manages to really hit that, you know. It's right at the beginning of the movie when Lex Luthor steps out of the room after that old lady dies. Right, by the way, I think that old lady was actually Phyllis Coates, maybe? One of the previous Lois Lanes. Right when he steps out of that room, and then he throws the wig at that girl. Like, the moment he steps out of the room, you're like, who? Menacing Lex Luthor? And then he throws that wig at that girl, and like, oh no, crap, it's Gene Hackman Lex Luthor again. You know, it's just the balance never hits either in the writing. So yeah, I agree, both of those characters need significant work, and that definitely has to start with the casting.
Yeah, and we should probably pick a different director here, because Bryan Singer, as like this dark cloud over everything, doesn't really help either.
No, it does not. And, you know, this whole move, like, messed up everything in a lot of ways. I mean, I know that, you know, given that Singer directed them, that's not great these days. But the most watchable X-Men movie is probably X2, right? And that one was directed by Singer, and he was set to direct X3 at the time, but walked away from the project to do Superman Returns. And instead of getting one, what could have been a decent X-Men movie, one decent superhero movie, we got two shoddy ones. So that this move didn't help anybody. Let's put it that way.
Which, if memory serves, was another problematic director, so trading one for another. And I even had this note, so while we're still here, I had previously had this as a note, but Sam Raimi, certain aspects of this film, Sam Raimi may want to file a cease and desist, because there are large elements of this feels like it's ripped out of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies, and so maybe that's our director replacement. Oh, wait, I did have that in the lightning round, but there you go. We're just kind of outside the lines here.
Sam Raimi can direct anything as far as I'm concerned. I like Sam Raimi as a director, I just do.
All right, so Dave, your next big fix is just, yep.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say, man. Again, it goes back to this nostalgia and trying to basically do the greatest hits with the various plot points. But did we really need another Lex Luthor real estate scheme? I think that's really the underlying issue. When it comes to like action, right? Because one of the critiques that was leveled against this movie, and I think one of the reasons we ended up with Zack Snyder as the director of Man of Steel, is that it is a very slow, plodding movie with no major action set pieces. There's really two, and it's like, maybe three. It's like, lift an airplane, lift a car, lift the Daily Planet globe, and lift a continent made out of kryptonite. Those are, like, if I wanted that much lifting, I could watch, like, the World Championship of Weightlifting, or maybe, you know, right? There is no major action set piece. There's nothing that Superman encounters that can stand up to him. And look, again, that harkens back to Superman the movie, right? But even Superman 2, even Donner Superman 2 realized that this is not a way that you can continuously have conflict, which is why he brought, you know, Zod in. That was planned from the get-go. We're going to have, you know, a SmackDown fight between three Kryptonian villains and Superman in the sequel. So why couldn't we do something like that here? And that's really, you want to bring Lex Luthor back? Fine. You want Lex Luthor to have a scheme to get rich or powerful? That's fine. You know, there's so many comic books or even cartoons that have done that better. Let's say he gets in contact with Brainiac, right? And brings Brainiac to Earth in exchange for something, right? And then we have a big fight at the end. There's so many different ways you can go here. He can, you know, use all that money that he's got to finance the creation of Metallo as a way of getting revenge on Superman because he's just spent all these years in prison, right? There's so many different directions to go here. The real estate thing, again, was the wrong choice. The central conflict comes across as immensely silly and derivative. So all I can say is say no to real estate.
Well, like, and here's the thing. I've said this before, and I know a lot of people kind of side-eye the Injustice games, but I enjoyed the central plot of Injustice 2 with Brainiac. And the fact that and I said this when you recommended the Superman 78 comic book series, the fact that we still haven't gotten Brainiac on screen is just stupid. It's stupid. Like, as a central Superman villain. Like, it's just dumb at this point. And so that plot taken from Injustice 2, a video game, is infinitely more interesting and compelling than what we've got here.
I agree, and I don't want to come across as a jerk or anything, but I'm just going to say this. It might be also time to say no to Lex, you know? I think that's one of my worries, even, about Superman Legacy. You know, in Gunn, I trust, generally speaking, but, you know, how often do we need to go to the Lex Luthor well at this point? He's becoming sort of the Joker of the Superman franchise, and that we just can't get away from this darn character. There are so many interesting Superman villains, right? And we constantly are getting Lex Luthor again and again and again and again ad nauseum at this point, right? Basically, there's the only two villains that the general public thinks Superman has is Lex Luthor and Zod. But there's so many good Superman villains. Superman, I would argue, has a rogues gallery almost as good as Spider-Man's once you really get into those comic books, right? So I just want something different, you know? And it's not just about Superman needs something to hit. I think just Superman needs to encounter challenges that are different from Lex Luthor at some point, too. And different from real estate. All right, that brings us to your second fix of the movie. And I think this is probably the fairest critique of all of this movie.
I think this film lacks the soul of Superman. It has all the window dressings of a Superman story, but none of the heart. Okay, so like I said, like the whole Sam Raimi vibe, but like there are elements of this film that are greatly enjoyable. I almost stood up and cheered when we got like the Perry White scene where like Superman's back and he's telling every department what to write about. Like, that was really cool. I know you geeked out a little bit as the journalism guy. But at the same time, you have like all of these weird elements in this film. I audibly stopped watching and took a break when we get Superman the Creep. He's just like scoping out Lois's new house with her new beau and kid. And the fact that the line that we kind of dovetail back to twice is, I'm always around. That seems like a really creepy double entendre. And so, like, we gotta look at that. Like people made jokes about Heimdall, like, seeing everything and how the problematic potential that is. Yeah, they doubled down on it here. Especially, is this a Bryan Singer self-insert? Like, what are we doing here? It's not a great look, Supes.
You know, a lot of that is problematic, and I think I'm going to get into that a little bit in my next fix for the movie. But yeah, that scene got a lot of criticism even at the time. There is something inherently creepy about a near omnipotent character hovering outside of your house and using X-ray vision and super hearing to spy on you. And even the lighting was oddly creepy on Superman in that, right? Like, it was such a misfire. Like, they couldn't even try to frame the situation in a more positive light or something, you know? And there have been scenes like that have worked a lot better, right? I remember might have been Superman's Secret Identity. I don't think it was Superman American Alien. There is a Superman book. It could have been Earth One as well, one of the Earth One volumes. Look at me spouting out all the comic books I'm reading. But there is a scene where Superman is in a restaurant by himself, and all of the colleagues that he works with from the Daily Planet are in a different establishment nearby, and they're talking about how, you know, Clark Kent is just like this absolute like waste, and he doesn't, you know, he's not interesting, and he's going to bore us all to tears. That's why we told him we're meeting somewhere else, so we don't have to put up with him. And he overhears that, and then there's just this sad moment of like, you know, he really didn't want to hear this, you know? And that's a much more interesting setup for something like that than Super Stalker, right? Maybe he was trying to fly over there to talk to her and just kind of overheard something he shouldn't have, and then he looks sad and flies away rather than literally going there specifically to spy, right? There is a way to execute that scene that doesn't come across as creepy, but, you know, leave it to Bryan Singer to not find a way to do that.
Well, and then we double down on it, with the scene towards the end with his son, which I think is a massive fumble. Like, I think there's a really interesting storytelling potential there. But then we have, like, this dramatic irony of we don't know what she whispered to him when he was in the hospital bed. Assumedly that he is the father of this child because he pushed a piano and killed somebody. but then, like, he just, like, creeps up into his bedroom and watches him sleep, and like this really heartfelt kind of speech, which was admittedly kind of cool, of him echoing Jor-El's speech to him, is completely muddled and any kind of goodwill is lost because he's watching this child sleep when it's not confirmed on screen that it's his father, like he's the father of this child.
Unleash me, Chris. I'm ready.
All right, go on for your third and final big fix of this film.
Okay. The entirety of the Lois Superman relationship needs a rewrite in this. And it's not just that Bosworth ain't no Lois Lane. The entire dynamic between Superman and Lois here is weird. And it is weird because we have to start looking at how this movie follows from the Donner movies and the Lester sequel, let's be honest. And what that says about the relationship between these two, okay? So let's go ahead and back up for a second and recap. Superman the movie, Superman and Lois meet. They instantly have chemistry. They're very much in love with each other. Superman literally, you know, turns the Earth backwards to save her life because he was too slow to save her. Which brings us into Superman 2, where Lois discovers Superman's secret. They have a passionate time after he becomes human for her, only to realize that Zod has been unleashed, and so he needs to go back to his fortress and try to get his powers back. And when he does, and Lois is tortured because there's a sense that they can't be together because Superman has to be for everybody, he lays a smackaroo on her that wipes her memory. Which brings us to Lois Lane is pregnant. Superman is gone. Who's the father according to Lois's own memory at this point? Because if her memory was wiped, how much memory did he wipe? Did he just wipe the memory of him being Clark Kent? Did he wipe the memory of their time together? In which case Lois is like, did I just like get like, you know, did somebody like sneak into my bedroom at night while I was asleep or something? How did I end up pregnant? How does she even know that Superman is the father then at that point, right? So let's just assume that he wiped the whole Clark Kent thing from her memory. What does that look like functionally? Does she find that she's in a relationship with a superhero who has a crystal fortress, but she doesn't really know who he is or where he hangs his hat? And how does that work as a relationship when he sees her every day at work, but pretends that he's not in love with her? That's just really weird, man. It's a really weird dynamic to bring a kid into. She doesn't even really know his name at this point.
And this is
right?
This is case in point to my second fix of it having all the window dressings of it, but that's not something that aligns with the soul of Superman.
There's just a really huge undercurrent of deceit and dishonesty, and then on top of that you add this pregnancy. Like, why exactly? Why exactly, even if she doesn't know he's Clark Kent, okay? Why exactly would he not say to her, hey, Lois, listen, I'm going to be gone for a little while because I need to check up on Krypton because, you know, astronomers have found where they think my home planet is and I just need to make sure that there were no survivors. But I'll be back. You just chill here. I'll see you soon. Like, what's the big deal even about saying that? Why could he not just tell her, hey, I'm going to be gone for a little while? What's with the disappearing act? Even that doesn't make any sense. Even within the continuity, there is no reason not to say, I'll be back soon. That doesn't make sense. And then you add the kid into the mix. And I'm going to tell you right now, even back then, I was not opposed to Superman having a kid.
But
right?
being a deadbeat dad?
Yeah, super dad is a great idea. Deadbeat super dad, not great. Now, in fairness, again, he didn't know that he had a kid, okay? So I'm willing to forgive that part at least a little bit, right? He ran off and was taking care of something and didn't realize that Lois was pregnant. Whatever, okay? But then we circle back around to the ending of this movie, right? And he doesn't even tell the kid. Lois and him may want to have a conversation with this kid. He's extremely confused because he threw a piano at a guy and killed him. I mean, I'm just saying, that guy did not survive after that piano was thrown at him. The force of that
he was
basically pancaked.
Well, they said he was dead in the film. Like, one of the other henchmen said, he's dead.
So that guy's dead. So this kid just killed somebody with a piano. You might want to sit him down and talk to him a little bit, okay? Like, you're not going to be able to keep this whole situation a secret. And again, that circles back then around to, you know, Clark Kent could be a part of this kid's life somewhat, but Lois doesn't even know that he's Clark Kent. And why does she not know that he's Clark Kent? They have a kid together. This whole thing is so deeply weird. Their entire dynamic is weird. Their little night flight in the original Superman, the movie, came across as incredibly romantic.
Whimsical.
Even with the cheesy poem. Yeah. Yeah, even with the cheesy poem that Lois was reciting, it's just romantic. This night flight came across as weird because their whole relationship is just based on deceit and keeping secrets from each other, and not even like sensible secrets, but like secrets that two people that share a kid probably shouldn't have from each other. The whole dynamic is so icky. And let me just add that even at the time that this movie was being made, everybody, before the movie even came out, everybody knew that this kid was Superman's kid. This was not a grand reveal. This was not a big secret. Nobody was surprised when that piano went flying across the room. Nobody. This was not an audible, oh my God, that's Superman's. Everybody knew walking into this movie. It was the worst kept secret in cinematic history, most likely. So you're not surprising anybody, right? You're not doing really anything. It's so frustrating that the key to the previous, you know, the Chris Reeves movies was the, you know, the relationship between Lois and Superman. Richard Donner even said, if you believe in the relationship between these two kids, you buy the whole movie. This is the hill that the movie will die on. We need to make sure you believe the chemistry between Superman and Lois. If you believe that chemistry, if you believe that relationship, the rest of the movie falls into place. And Singer, who's clearly a fan of those movies, completely fails in that respect because you never believe the relationship between these two people. They have zilch chemistry, and the writing doesn't even try to lean into any kind of chemistry between the two. And I'm going to say the resolution of this movie and the lack of resolution in that relationship was also really icky. You can say, okay, Lois has moved on and she prefers now being with Richard and whatever, okay? That you can say that. But it feels like such a downer ending in a lot of ways for Routh that then fly into space Chris Reeve style and smile at the camera. I mean, he is truly and utterly alone. His girl is with another guy. His son is being raised by another man. At the beginning of the movie, he figures out that there is no other survivors on Krypton. He is well and truly alone. It is the most downer ending for a Superman story that I have probably ever seen. And that's where we leave things. And then he smiles at the camera, so everything is supposed to be fine. It just doesn't work. The entire Lois Superman thing, the linchpin of this movie, is a complete and utter failure. So here's my proposed fix. It's a small thing, but it would make a huge difference. So let's say that Lois knows that Superman and Clark are the same person. Let's say Lois knows that Superman is leaving. Let's say Superman says, this whole thing is going to take me about 6 months and I'll be back. And I'm sorry, I just really have to check this out. Lois knows that she is pregnant, but she doesn't tell Superman. Because she's like, when he comes back, we'll talk about things and how we figure out this relationship. He has other stuff going on right now. We will address this later. Only instead of this taking 6 months, it takes 5 years. And why does it take 5 years? Let's go ahead and bring something in from the comic books. On the way back to Earth, Superman gets captured by Mongol. He gets put on War World, and he has to fight as a gladiator. And it takes him another 4 years to fight free of that and return to Earth. And now, he's not a deadbeat dad. Now, he's just a guy who got captured and had to fight his way back home. And when he comes back home, now he's facing all these difficulties. And Lois doesn't have this whole why the world doesn't need Superman stuff. She's just conflicted because she thought that he died out there. And she moved on with life. And now suddenly he's back. And the whole relationship situation rings a lot more true and is a much more interesting conflict. Because then we avoid the deadbeat dad stuff. For one, right? And we have a much more interesting dynamic between Superman and Lois. Two people who, from the word go, still feel love for each other, right? But time has gone by. And so how can you recapture that? Or is that gone? And now we just have to find a new dynamic. And her knowing then that Clark is Superman makes the scenes that we have at the Daily Planet a lot more interesting, too. The best Daily Planet scene, besides Perry White being Perry White, is probably when the kid looks up at Clark Kent and has an asthma attack because he realizes Clark Kent's Superman, right? Like, that scene is like one of the scenes that actually clicks in this movie. Now, imagine if Lois was in on that, you know? It would have been a much, much better scene even then. It's the entire Lois-Superman dynamic. This is where things fail, Chris.
Well, here's the thing, too, that I had thought about while watching. Like, no one knows that Clark is Superman, right? Then how do we explain Superman's absence, but not Clark's? Like, isn't it kind of sus, as the kids would say, that both disappeared for 5 years without a trace? Like,
yes, it's totally sus, and it's never addressed.
Not once. There's so much to unpack here. I feel like we're going to start to rival the runtime of this film with this episode. inexplicably 2 hours and 37 minutes. It's so bad. There's so much.
Without Snyder slow-mo.
Yeah.
Without Snyder slow-mo, this movie is dead long.
Well, there's some slow-mo that actually works in this film, but there's so much there that, like, he comes across, the dynamic is so uncomfortable. Like, their first interaction, like, she just forgets about him. Like, there is no chemistry. There is no spark. It's like, oh, yeah, that guy I used to work with who I kind of forgot his name is back at work. Like, it's just like this forgettable coworker. Not, like, any real connection there whatsoever.
And the thing is, he was not a forgettable coworker. You know, like, if you look at the other movies, she liked Clark. She thought he was a big goof, right. But she liked Clark just fine. Right.
And the whole Pulitzer article writing, the journalistic integrity in this film, I'm sure, is a bad beat for you. Because, like, here's the thing. She wins a Pulitzer for Why the World Doesn't Need Superman. And then once she gets a smooch or two, then she immediately retracts her statement that won her the most prestigious award in journalism.
Yeah, what can I say? It's those super lips still get you every time. They make you forget all sorts of stuff. All right, Chris, that brings us to your final fix of this movie.
Speaking of Lois, she makes some monumentally boneheaded moves in this film, and it's such a disservice to a smart, quick-witted character. First and foremost, like, it's really admirable that she, maybe inspired by her relationship with Superman, goes for the hero move of saving the presenter lady on the airplane. But if you've ever been on an airplane and listened for 5 seconds, they say secure yourself before helping others or children. And so by trying to save this lady, she's the one that's in peril on this airplane. It's a mess. And then the piece de resistance is just walking with your child onto someone else's... Is this trespassing? The kid's like, yo, mom, this is effed up. Like, we're just trespassing on private property on this boat. And predictably, it doesn't go well for you, Lois. What are we doing? So, yeah. Like, come on. Let Lois be smart. Like, it feels like an underlying hint of misogyny in this. Like, why is she so doofy in this? It's not right.
Yeah, yeah. And I think... I got this in my lightning round, but I'm going to go ahead and remove it because it needs to be said here. She doesn't even come across as a very good journalist, ultimately. Like,
a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist.
The first time that we see her, she's on this new space shuttle flight, right? And on this airplane that is like the space shuttle is piggybacking on, which, you know, that's an interesting setup, actually. And she asks about what the average person is going to be expected to pay for a space flight. And the spokesperson is like, it's in the press packet, girl. Did you even read the press packet?
Girl! I was so pissed. Girl!
I was like, you telling me that you didn't even read the prep work? And this is supposed to be one of the greatest journalists on Earth? Holy smokes, man. But yeah, you're exactly right. She... You know, the thing is, I'm not a big fan of Amy Adams' version of Lois Lane either, but Amy Adams, I'm a big fan of Amy Adams. I like her as an actress a great deal. And I think the failure there is very much in the writing for the most part. There's absolutely none of the fire or the spunk that makes Lois Lane Lois Lane. But by God, if they didn't at least try to make her a journalist.
I'm going to try and edit myself here for Pete's sake. We'll say for Pete's sake, in the Snyder Cut, she wasn't allowed to speak.
Yeah, but you know, if you look at Man of Steel, at least she's trying to investigate something, you know? Like, there is a sense that she's trying to be a journalist, right? But here, every effort of her to be a journalist... Look, the thing that even won her a Pulitzer was an opinion piece. You know? It wasn't even investigative journalism. It was an opinion piece that won her a Pulitzer. She does not come across as a serious journalist in this movie in any way, shape, or form.
We also have to stop with investigative journalists turning into the Last Action Hero. What are we doing?
Yeah. And then, you know, the problem that you mentioned with her taking her kid on this boat, one of the things about Lois Lane before she's a mother in the comic books is that she does put herself in dangerous situations because she believes the truth is that important, and because in the back of her mind she always feels like Superman's gonna be there. But I don't think that Lois Lane is interested in putting other people
child endangerment.
She puts herself in harm. The fact that she takes her kid is not in character for Lois Lane. Lois Lane cares too much about other people. She can be reckless with her own safety sometimes, but she is not reckless with other people's safety. I think that misses the point of Lois as a character. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
All right, so those are our three big fixes, but now we're not done, so we need a lightning round. Dave, I really dig your first lightning round fix.
I think one of the things that you notice about when you watch this movie is how wooden Routh sometimes comes across. And that's not at all him. If you've seen him in any other roles, and I've seen him in a ton, I'm a fan, right? I had him on Chuck. We had him as Ray Palmer in the Arrowverse. He obviously reprised Superman there as well. He's an incredibly charming, affable, and warm guy. And I don't know why they don't unleash that in this movie. There are so many shots of him just basically being silent. He doesn't really say much. If you look at Chris Reeve's Superman, he's a talker. He's constantly saying stuff, you know? He's constantly interacting with people. And Routh is such a quiet dude. Even as Clark Kent, he doesn't have much to say. But then as Superman, he's even more quiet, you know? There's so many shots of him just quietly contemplating or looking, right? He's a very passive Superman. And I think one of the fixes this movie desperately needed was to lean into Routh's natural charm. Superman is a warm and charming individual. And so stifling Routh, who is a warm and charming individual in every other role you'll ever see him, it seems like such a weird choice. Like, unleash Routh in this movie, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's so weird because, like, I don't buy any of the Zorro, Diego de la Vega, like, shtick of Clark Superman. Like, there is no, because he's so muted in this film, there's no clear distinction between the two characters. So, like, I felt most of the way through the movie, like, how are y'all not picking up that this is the same dude? Because there's no clear distinction between the two of them.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, what's your first lightning fix?
Okay, so when I mentioned this earlier, but the missed opportunity with Jason, the kid, I thought, like, the whole time watching this movie, even though I'd already seen it, I'd forgotten so much because it'd been a decade plus since I've seen it. This would have been so easy to have Jason having respiratory issues would have been like a cool way to introduce his superpowers. Like, he's adapting to being of mixed heritage, like being half Kryptonian, half Earthling. Like, I thought that would have been a really cool way to kind of adapt into like his powers coming into full force and like awakening, but there's nothing made out of that. So that would have been really cool to kind of tap in on that thread.
I totally agree with that. I think there's something to be said for what kind of difficulties does he have being both. But since they're trying to play coy, like this is some kind of huge secret, we never get to really do much with this character, right? If they would have just come out from the get-go and just been like, yeah, this is Superman's kid, we could have had a lot more fun. And by fun, I mean a lot more relevant parts to the movie that involve him, I think. At this point, he feels more like a MacGuffin. Yeah.
All right, Dave, your next lightning round fixed is surprising to me that it wasn't one of the big fixes.
I'm going to go ahead and I'm gonna wave my finger at James Gunn here too, okay? What is the obsession with bringing back an Otis and a Miss Teschmacher? Can somebody explain that to me? Because I don't think they were that important.
Oh, this is not the one. Scheme. Okay. Oh, you're on with a different one. But keep going. Keep cooking.
Yeah, so I just really want to talk about this, right? Parker Posey is a very charismatic actress and could have done some interesting things. I even suggested her as a possible swap with Kate Bosworth for Lois, right? Even James Gunn has now cast an Otis and a Miss Teschmacher. Why? You know, I don't think we necessarily need that. I understand the idea that we need somebody to bounce off of Alpha Flex, but I think Parker Posey's character is a complete waste here. She's completely wasted. A really, really strong actress doing basically nothing in this movie. And I don't understand it. I don't understand what this urge is to have these specific hench people, if you will, involved in this movie. I didn't think we need Kitty here, and I'm not sure we need a Miss Teschmacher in the next movie. I don't think that is an essential feature of having a Lex Luthor. I mean, these characters are not necessarily from the comic books, right? What is the point of this unless they solve some kind of important plot point? The character really doesn't, right? And I feel bad for Parker Posey because she's a really good actress and I enjoy watching her on screen. But lo and behold, she doesn't really get to do anything here.
Yeah, I thought she was cute and fun, like the first half of the film, like with the breaks being cut, that whole scene was kind of fun. But then like the second part of the film, that really final third act, I guess, is she's just sitting there looking sad with her dog. Like, she doesn't even do anything. Like, she drops the crystals, I guess that's nice, but like then it leads to nothing, and then they're just stranded on a deserted island.
Yep, exactly. So what's your next quick fix?
Why the F is her password just Superman? Like, there's no... What? Just the word Superman. No symbols, no special characters required, no capitalization restraints, no numbers required. It's just the one word Superman. Like, get out of here. I know it's a movie trope that shows up quite often where it's just one word, simple as crap, but like it's just stupid.
Here again, you could have had a lot more fun if she would actually know Superman, right? Like, her password, for example, could have been Kal-El, and he would have had to, like, put his real name in while nobody's looking to unlock. Oh, look, I was able to unlock the computer. What was her password? I don't know. I just pushed random buttons, right? You could have had something going on here which you could buy that, you know, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with confidential sources makes sure that her computer's properly password protected.
I mean, like, even if you are, and I'm guilty of having the same password, or similar enough passwords, but like at least there's a little bit of encryption there, like a little bit of zhuzhing it up. Like I'm at a loss for words. Dave, what is your next lightning round fix?
This should have been a big one, but Superman's look is really weird in this
bad.
Movie.
Oh, it's
and
bad.
There's a couple of things.
How is this not a big fix?
I think there's a couple of things that went really wrong here. The first is the inversion of Clark Kent and Superman's hairstyles. Superman's hairstyle always felt a little bit more natural, and Clark had a whole bunch of product in his hair, like very slicked back, sort of, like, you know, 1950s businessman kind of look, right? Which worked because Superman, 70s Superman, was basically supposed to be sort of a 1950s anachronism, right? Because he was locked up in the fortress for so long training, right? So he comes out, you know, with the fedora and everything looking like you know, somebody from the 50s. But here they invert that. And so Clark has this very natural-looking hair. And then Superman is like... his hair looks like it's spray-painted on. It looks so bizarre when he steps on to that airplane after saving it for the first time. And he looks like a plastic doll. It does not look like Superman. He looks like a you know, Madame Tussauds wax museum version of Superman. The suit is also really weird to me because they made the S really small, which makes the blue really dominant. They muted the colors. And then on top of that, the suit is a very odd material. It almost reminds me of like a diving suit or something, you know? And so when you have something as simple as the original Superman suit that Chris Reeves wore, that sort of spandex look, it kind of has a texture to it, right? And when you look at the Superman suit that they made for Henry Cavill, it kind of has a texture to it. Now, that one a little more purposefully, right? But it feels like a very natural sort of real material. But this material from the Superman suit is almost too slick and shiny. It's kind of uncanny to look at him. And the final thing that I think really is often about the suit is how small the opening for his head is at the top of the suit, right? Because traditionally the Superman suit is sort of has a very wide opening at the top, which makes it possible for the cape to tuck in a very comfortable way. He has a tucked in cape look, right? And so it works really well like that because there's a very wide opening, so the cape has a lot of room to sort of billow and move. But when you make that opening up top too small, then that doesn't work. And that's why oftentimes when they try to make that opening smaller, like in the New 52 or with the initial suit that Arrow vs. Superman wore, they then attach the cape on the outside of the suit, which is a very different look and I don't think necessarily works. But the opening of the hole at the top of the suit is too small, and then you add that cape and tuck it in, and it looks all squishy and weird. So if you take all of these things together, the material used for the suit, the really weird hairstyle choices, the opening too small, which makes the cape look all squishy, he comes across as a doll. The look is all wrong.
You missed the worst part, the most egregious part. Why does he have a leather cape?
seems unnecessarily heavy.
Yeah,
right?
It's so...
I mean, not that it would bother Superman, but it just doesn't have that same potential for waving in the wind. You
yeah,
know what
it's
I mean?
It's just a bad look. It is not... It's so forgettable. Like, it doesn't stand out. It's not, like, something you're like, I remember this look. And part of that is like the reduced size of the logo as well. But yeah, it's just a terrible, terrible costume.
All right, so what is your next quick fix?
Superman making some rookie mistakes, like when he saves the plane. Like, clearly you just trying to hold the wing of the plane, just like the weight distribution of that, just was not a smart choice. And surprise, surprise, the wing flies off because all of that resistance, you know, force going backwards did not have the structural ability to hold still. So yeah, that scene in particular, like that plane was kicking his ass. Like it was a struggle on that scene. So you can tell like he's been out of the game for a while.
Yeah, and there was talk about, you know, among fans, was he fully charged up yet, or is he just rusty, you know? But yeah, I remember in interviews they were talking about trying to obey the laws of physics a little more. So when you really try to take like a heavy, large object like that and slow it down, and you're a small object, that there would be, you know, structural integrity issues, right? And so that's what they were apparently going for, but it doesn't make him look great, right?
All right, I knew you were going to tap into this at some point, Dave. What is your next lightning round fix?
So they have this very short flashback to Smallville and when he was a kid and he first realized he could fly, which is a great scene and perfectly filmed and very well acted by the child actor, and I really like that scene, but it serves absolutely zero purpose. Like, there is no plot reason for that to be there. It doesn't speak to the theme of the movie. It doesn't accomplish anything. And so why is that there? It needed to have some kind of tie to the plot or the emotional arc of the movie or something in order to justify that being there. Otherwise, it just adds to the runtime. And I really wish they would have been able to tie some kind of flashback into the overall arc of the movie instead of doing this really useless, you know, flashback that doesn't do anything.
Well, I thought you were talking about another scene at first, because another evidence of the Force Awakens of it all is the same way he crashes back home. And it like confused me at first. I was like, wait, is this when he crashed as a baby, or are we just pulling the hits again?
And, you know, again, why can't he land? You know, like, if he would have been, like, in an escape pod or something from Warworld trying to get away, you know, then that would have been a much better reason for him to crash again. But again, they just didn't think this stuff through. What is your next quick fix, Chris?
This is an overall thing, but this film is cartoonishly dorky, even in ways, like, the cartoons aren't, like... we have a better animated Lex Luthor than we have a live action Lex Luthor, and a more cartoonishly Lex Luthor in the live action. Like the whole wig thing, like it's so doofy. Like this is such a dweeby, dorky film, and like the whole aesthetic is kind of hampered by this.
You can forgive the dweeby dorky stuff in the original movies because they're so right. Old. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. Why are you making a 1970s film in 2006?
In 2006. Yeah. And that yeah, it's completely out of time. Yeah, exactly.
Dave, this is a lightning round fix, or is it?
More score. Like, I'm gonna be completely honest with you, man. I said no nostalgia, and I stand by that. The nostalgia is really what kills this movie. But I'd be darned if John Ottman didn't take the John Williams themes and just add wonderful, yeah, beautiful layers to this. I wonder what John Ottman could have done if he had a little bit of more freedom to play with the themes, instead of being told, okay, here you need to use the Krypton theme, and here you need to use the original Superman theme, and here you need to use the flying at night theme, because everything that he adds to Williams' original score is just beautiful, complex layers of musicality. I love the score of this movie. It might be the best thing that came out of this movie. I bought this score on CD, and I used to listen to it in my car. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. It's the best of both.
That's the nerdiest thing I've ever heard.
I am a nerd, my friend. It combines the pompous Beautiful go big or go home parts of the Williams score that I love, but it also does beautiful calm and complex things within, and kind of just layers on top of that. I think it might be one of my favorite superhero movie scores, believe it or not. And so I really do wonder what Ottman could have done with a little bit more freedom here. I think the score is gorgeous. So more John Ottman, I guess.
Yeah, no arguments here. I mean, like, I know you like lob it up to nostalgia, but John Williams is timeless, man. There is no timestamp on that one. So no arguments here.
I agree. All right, what's another quick fix you got?
Why is Cal Penn here? Why is he here?
What's going to happen?
He has speaking line. Did he get, as you said in our text thread, did he get lost on his way back from White Castle? Like, what are we doing here? Like, he's so, like, this could easily just been anybody. Like, why is he here?
I don't know, but I don't think he was really needed, was he?
Oh my God.
There was so much speculation back then about what role he was gonna, play, in the movie, and there was like talk that he was like gonna be like a double crosser, double agent. He was gonna befriend Superman, but he's really working for Lex Luthor. And there's gonna be a huge betrayal scene at the end, and it shake Superman's faith in humanity because somebody that he thought was a friend betrays him. And then he has like one line. Now, according to an interview from I think 2017 or something, Penn actually said that he did have around 20 speaking lines in the movie, but most of them were edited out in the final cut. So
he's just walking around looking at half the time. Like, what? Oh, and another thing. Oh, that reminds me, one of the dorky things. Like, why do we have like a model city? Like, what are we doing? What was that? That was weird.
Yeah, I think that the Cal Penn thing is almost like to the point of distraction, because you're constantly waiting, like, he's a big actor, why is he not doing anything? Like, what is he going to do before this movie's over? I'm really distracted by his presence at this point.
All right, Dave, your last lightning round fix. I got a couple more, but you got one more here.
Drop the wig stuff.
That's so weird.
And I'm not necessarily saying that you have to drop the wig completely.
What Zack Snyder said? More of that. Like, let's lean into it.
Like, I didn't quite understand why every time they leaned in on the wigs, it had to be filmed like it's a scary movie.
Yes.
Like at the beginning when he throws the
wig, like
he gets lost in
the wig room. Like,
yeah, like there's the screams of the girl at the beginning when he throws the wig at her. like she's, you know, being murdered, and then the wig room, like, every it's like has a score like Alfred Hitchcock or something, like the absolute abject fear of these wigs. Is like Bryan Singer have some kind of like issues with like getting older and potentially
does he have a prejudice against follically challenged people?
It's really weird that those were all scary moments. Every time there was a wig on screen, it was like a horror movie suddenly. Like, let's just excise that. All right, what are your other two quick fixes, Chris?
This maybe leans into the dorky stuff, or like focusing on the wrong thing. Like the scene where the cabbie drops his cigar and it causes this big explosion was just a weird choice. Like, we can't get like the big things right, but we're gonna focus on this tiny little cigar. It was a weird choice.
It was, yeah.
And then leave it to Bryan Singer to cast James Marsden in a role and then completely underutilize him. But I wanted more Superman and Cyclops together. I think that that was a pleasant surprise, was the chemistry. Like, Routh and Marsden had more chemistry than Routh and Bosworth
more
did.
More chemistry than
like so, like, I guess just, sorry, Lois, but you're the third wheel on this one. Just more of them together then.
She's basically the Jean in that situation. We just go ahead and remove her and let Cyclops and Wolverine just have their
Scott
fun.
Let Scott and Logan
right?
kiss.
I totally agree.
Oh boy. Okay, that is our fix. That was a weird note to end it on, but that is our fix of Superman Returns. What did we miss? What fixes would you make? Hit us up on social media at Nerd by Word or individually, that Nerd Dave and that Nerd Chris. When we come back from this supersized episode, we are going to nerd commend two more good things that we actually enjoyed. All right, welcome back to our final segment. It is fan favorite. It is beloved. It is called All right, Dave, what do you have for us this week?
I have a find from a used bookstore, my absolute favorite thing. I love a good used bookstore. And I picked up a book about movies that has a copyright of like 2001, so there might be even a newer edition at this point if they updated it. But it's called The Greatest Sci-Fi Movies Never Made and was written by David Hughes. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read you like the dust jacket summary of the movie. These are just some of the legendary unmade films covered in this groundbreaking book, proving that even if you are one of the most powerful names in Hollywood, development can still be hell. This expanded and fully updated edition also reveals the fascinating details of the movies that nearly were. What would James Cameron's version of Spider-Man or Terry Gilliam's Watchmen have been like? How close did Ridley Scott come to directing I Am Legend, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger? And why was Nicolas Cage paid $20 million for not playing Superman? The book touches on all sorts of unmade science fiction movies, including Steven Spielberg's Night Skies, which was a horror-tinged forerunner to E.T., Stanley Kubrick's Childhood's End, Philip Kaufman's Star Trek Planet of the Titans, Kevin Smith's $6 Million Man, Tim Burton's Superman Lives, and John Favreau's John Carter of Mars. I really, really like this book, man, for a number of reasons. This has a whole bunch of interviews, exclusive interviews with writers, designers, and directors involved in some of these movies. It's meticulously researched. It touches on a whole bunch of interesting movies that we never got to see, and some alternate versions of books we did get to see. For example, there are so many different versions, unproduced versions of Dune before we got to the place where we are now, right? Some of these were actually really interesting looking. There's a chapter in here on the efforts to make a Silver Surfer movie, the efforts to make a Fantastic Four movie before the one that we eventually did get. There's a whole long chapter on Richard Stanley's version of The Island of Dr. Moreau that never got made. Efforts to make a television version of The Outer Limits is in here. There's just some really, really fascinating, sort of meditations on movies that could have been. And as a huge fan of science fiction movies, this immediately spoke to me. And it's a fairly hefty tome, all things considered. The paperback version I have here comes in at about 325 pages, and the type is fairly small. So you get a really sort of detailed deep dive into the attempted makings of these movies. So if you're a fan of science fiction or superhero films and you want to get a little bit more background on some of the stuff that we almost had, or alternate versions of the things we did get, this is a fantastic choice. And I think I'm going to do some research and find out if they've updated this book again since 2001, because it would be fascinating. Or maybe there's a sequel to dive into some of the stuff that's happened since then, Chris. Fantastic book. Really highly recommended.
Yeah, I'm ready to read this one. I'm seeing a version on Amazon from 2008. So, but yeah, I think part of one of the positive byproducts of making this podcast is it's made me more alert and aware of the effects directors have on a film. And so seeing these kind of great what ifs is really kind of fascinating. I'll never forget getting that issue of Entertainment Weekly with Nicolas Cage on the cover as Superman, and like as a kid just wondering whatever happened to that.
Yeah, I think you're going to have fun with this one if you give it a shot, Chris. All right, so what's your nerd commendation this week?
Sometimes I avoid nerd commending X-Men stuff just because I know that you're not going to have much to comment on. But I'm going to go ahead and do it because there was a poll question on Twix yesterday of like, what's the best comic you've read recently? And it's either Immortal Thor, which I've previously nerd commended and nerd commend again, like keep up reading that. Like as of the time recording, we just got the Roxxon Presents Thor. That was really kind of tongue-in-cheek and really kind of breaking down the fourth wall of so much societal critiques. And but I mean, like, Al Ewing is just cooking, and I believe this just wrapped up, but The Resurrection of Magneto is just like a really powerful journey, both through the eyes of Magneto and Storm. So like, if you're a fan of those two characters, I think it's new reader friendly enough. You don't have to keep up with all the Krakoa mess. Like, this is the only real title in the X line right now that kind of gave me any kind of enjoyment. I've made my feelings clear on the trajectory of the X books. Maybe the new era, once we finally get away from this debacle of ending Krakoa and this expeditious retreat is over, maybe I'll find some enjoyment out of that. But it's interesting that a nostalgia bait cartoon is giving me more enjoyment than most X-Men comics. But Resurrection of Magneto is like the diamond in the rough, and the very, very rough. You have this incredible journey of like the afterlife and spirituality and having accountability for your past transgressions on Magneto's part. The art alone is worth the price of admission from friend of the show, Luciano Vecchio, the first creator we ever interviewed, Dave. And now to see him kind of front and center as like one of Marvel's biggest artists is really, really cool to see. And what he's able to accomplish with like that almost kind of Sailor Moon kind of anime type of vibes with his art is just really cool to see center stage. Some gorgeous splash pages. But I highly recommend this book if you haven't already read it. Al Ewing is at the top of his game. He's one of those writers, along with Jed McKay, along with Jonathan Hickman, that I will just follow to the ends of the earth and read whatever they're writing. Except maybe Venom. I may read Al Ewing's Venom. It's not my cup of tea. But other than that, like everything that Al touches is he's got the Midas touch when it comes to writing stuff for me.
Yeah, I might have to check this out. I've not been, obviously, you know, X-Men agnostic here, but I had been reading the most recent Scarlet Witch book, and they were kind of dealing a little bit with the fallout of Magneto dying. So that might be my in to actually give this one a shot, Chris. I think I'm going to give this one a shot on your nerd commendation, as long as I don't have to be too deep into the X-Men world, because, you know, I just don't have the energy for all that.
And that's my thoughts exactly on DC, so at least it's a mutual understanding. All right, that wraps another episode. This may be our longest in recent memory, Dave. We have really strong feelings about Superman Returns. Yes, thank sir. You for riding along with us. We thank you so much for being in on this journey with us. Thank you for your support. If you like what you heard today, please go to your podcasting platform of choice, like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or nerdbyword.com.
And find us on social media and let us know exactly how you felt about Superman Returns and what you think could be done to improve it. We would love to hear your thoughts. You can find us on pretty much any social media platform at Nerd by Word, and on select platforms at That Nerd Dave and at That Nerd Chris.
And as always, stay well and stay nerdy.
The Nerd by Word is written and produced by Chris and Dave, two nerds with a love of all things pop culture. The podcast features music by Al Jimenez, with additional drops composed by Joe Biondi. Our show art is by Ashery Design. Find us at nerdbyword.com and wherever podcasts are available.